The Dornish leader forked a stallion black as sin, with a mane and tail the color of fire. He sat his saddle as if he'd been born there, tall, slim, graceful. A cloak of pale red silk fluttered from his shoulders, and his shirt was armored with overlapping rows of copper disks, glittered like a thousand bright new pennies as he rode. His high gilded helm displayed a copper sun on its brow, and the round shield slung behind him bore the sun and spear of House Martell on its polished metal surface. Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Originally founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched with the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community. This is Season 10 of the White Book Podcast. Mentally, I just picture for this. Not necessarily any of the pieces she's already done, but like, I just picture her style for the Red Viper in this particular instance.
Pieces she would do about Song of Ice and Fire that are paid for by FFG, which I don't think is very likely these days.
Yeah, yeah. She's moved on to higher paying projects.
Or just working directly for Martin, which I imagine it pays more.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, oh yeah, didn't she do some stuff on the latest calendar or something?
And she did the World of Ice and Fire.
Gotcha. Yeah, cutting out that middleman probably gets her a little more.
A lot, probably a lot more, to be honest.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
As long as she can do it at distance, so she doesn't get arrested.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had almost forgotten that whole nightmare scenario.
Yeah, I still think her relationship with Wizards is just fine. Considering, like, they just had her do a bunch of really important art for their gigantic set they're releasing in a couple weeks. I'm Roy.
I'm Glazer, obviously.
And I'm Will. This is episode 377 of The White Book.
This podcast.
So that means, was the review episode 375 then?
No, the 375 wound up being the segmented episode with the interviews with folks involved with the different player run tours with yourself and Chris and Remco and Sid.
Cool.
Oh, we let Sid on this podcast. There goes the neighborhood.
Oh, I know, right? The thing is, though, like, he was one of the most like concise, straightforward, best guests / co-hosts I've ever had. Like, he ran through every question I could have thought of on his own, without me asking, in half the time of anyone else. It was amazing.
Sid, he's the best. So, Glazer, what are we talking about tonight?
Oh, wait, we're not doing, like, I'm so used to not transitioning. Like, there's no giveaways, there's no new pack spoiled, there's nothing to,
I've probably got one bit of news. We haven't really had anything on the FFG front, like official-wise, but by the time this episode comes out, I should hopefully have had everything in place to announce that we are hosting U.S. Nationals once again. So, happy about that.
Congrats.
Congratulations, Will.
Thank you. Thank you. So, head over to agotnationals.com to check out the site and info for that. We're still nailing down some timing issues and thoughts at the time of recording, but it will be Labor Day weekend again. So that's going to be August 31st and September 1st. And we did nail down today probably the biggest moving piece, which is that we are going to run the Swiss portion Saturday in the local, quote, castle, end quote. I feel like I need to do that so our European friends understand the distinction. This is the Americanized faux castle version. But it's still a really cool historical building built by a former, well, I guess actually it is still a fraternal order that exists called the Knights of Pythias, but they are no longer the owners and users. So Pythian Castle, we will be there. There's going to be beer and things there at the event. It should be a good time. More will be announced.
Can we name it Pythlek?
Pythlek. I don't know if that really rolls off the tongue. It sounds dirty.
Exactly. But every Thrones player will get the lek and, like, you know, Pythlek.
Yeah.
American Stalin.
Yeah.
Pythlek.
That's the goal. There's nowhere to stay literally at the castle, unfortunately, here to Stalin. But if we can capture even some inkling of that feel, I think it's going to be a good time. So always wanting to do bigger and better.
Definitely excitement.
Especially relevant given that this is the last year of traditional worlds. So if this does become tradition, which it should, this could easily replace whatever weird invitational thing they're doing with the World Championships as the major event in the U.S. Thrones calendar.
Yep. Definitely definitely had my fingers crossed for that. So.
Yeah.
Rest assured, we are hard at work to take everything we learned from last year and make this one even better. So we've got a lot of folks on this. It's going to be good.
Well, Nationals was such a huge success in last year and a real testament to your ability as a tournament organizer, Will. So I'm really glad that FFG was able to notice that and reward you for your hard work.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad it went well. Numbers are up, so hopefully we'll just keep growing. And maybe the old Nationals curse is broken.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's all the news I have for the moment. now we can transition to Aaron's topic.
Okay, so I was on Team Martell during Thrones War. Well, no, try time out, lie, during Jesse's name day. Sorry, war format event. I was unfortunately on Team's Night's Watch during Thrones War, but let's not speak of that.
Rip Johnny Wright.
No. I love Johnny Wright. It's just builders. Yay. However, I was on Team Martell during Jesse's name day, under Chris Schoenthal, along with Alejandro Pantoja. A few days prior to the tournament, Alejandro and I sat down and made a list of what ended up being 26 tips for how to effectively play Martell fairly in a vacuum. We also did like further tips for how to play against each house as Martell, but we're not going to go over that. What we're going to do today is we're going to look at the 26 tips for how to play Martell, assuming you're not super familiar with the house, which many of our newer players weren't.
I'm very confused. I really could have sworn you said it was 25 tips when you told us, like, last week.
I thought it was 25, but when I look at the list, I see 26. So here we are.
Okay. I was hoping you were going to say you stealthily added one afterward.
Well, there is a zero that I would assume Chris added. Like, if I check edit history, editing? How do I check edit history? I don't remember. Oh, well.
I never need to use that.
Last edit was 14 days ago by Anonymous. I believe Anonymous would have been Schoenthal in this case. Yeah. Tip zero, by the way, is wear sunscreen.
Always wear. That if that doesn't date, well, at this point, probably all of us. I don't know what does.
I don't know. 3 years, maybe. So what? What's the first tip?
Tip one is don't always trigger Desert Raider. It's very, very often useful to keep him in the discard pile for a threat of activation to make sure that you can get rid of the icon you want when you want instead of just having him in play and being kind of a crappy military icon. Also, consider power totals. Like, think about how much renown they have. I've seen multiple Martell players lose the game because they're like, trigger Desert Raider. I'm like, cool, that gives me enough renown to close now. So don't just trigger it. Think about it.
Yeah. I think that's one that gets easily overlooked, especially even in the early game. Like, even if your opponent's only sitting on, you know, like 5 power or something, like that's still worth kind of counting and reasoning. Don't give them the extra. You don't have to.
If it's not accomplishing anything, don't. Also, don't trigger it if you're about to march. Like, nothing's more annoying than a discarded Desert Raider.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is very true. It doesn't do anything in the discard pile. So your second one is always draw first. Schemes, Traitor, and Dorne. Whatever you, those are just some of the card advantage engines. That doesn't even include Rivergate, the new one, and other cards. They may change your plans. And this is the thing I struggle with a lot in my own play, not just playing with Martell, but playing with just any draw-heavy faction that could be Stark, that could be Night's Watch, and it's just a really important thing to keep in mind. Any of these decks don't necessarily have the most linear game plan or have to play out of really difficult situations. It's really important to understand what all your options are going to be. And so making sure that you do your schemes at the beginning of challenges, marshaling, is a huge deal.
Yeah. So schemes and trade you're doing because they'll change the way you marshal. The only time schemes, you have to wait till it's long enough for you to do so. But once you plan on schemes, and if you know you're going to schemes that term, just do it first. Traitor is basically always the first card on Marshall, unless I know I need the gold for something else. And there's usually like 3 or 4 different things I want to do within an action window when I have Dorne. So always trigger Dorne first. Make sure you get whatever that action is off before anything else happens, with one exception. When do you want to trigger a different card than Dorne first? I'll give you a hint. It's against Sea of Blood. You need to say Viper Eyes after they see a blood, not Dorne. With that exception, just Dorne first.
Yeah, right. Just make sure it's after their Sea of Blood, though. Don't get too trigger happy. Yeah.
Well, the odds are they're going to Sea of Blood first. You know what I mean? Like, if they chose not to Sea of Blood first, then they had the event they were going to play to blow up your Dorne already anyway.
Very fair.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if they want the reduction particularly early, they have to trigger Sea of Blood first. So.
Martell is really good against Sea of Blood of all shapes and sizes. I think only the Shadows of its major builds really has severe trouble with Sea of Blood. Usually it just rolls Sea of Blood decks. Although Stark Sea with its mid-rangey bullshit isn't really normal Sea. Like, it's a toolbox for Stark, whereas for Greyjoy and Targ, it's an aggro tool.
Yeah, Stark is the least linear of the Sea of Blood decks, but it just kind of pushes their already strong cards over. So I think it is probably the one that Martell struggles the most with, particularly if they're running Frosso. All right. Number 3, Glazer, what's that?
Open with Dorne's Behest. If you're running it, just open with it. This was more relevant before At the Gates became the standard opener of the game. But in general, you just really want to open with Behest. You want to get that used plot in. You want to make it so that, like, if you drop a Ricasso, you can immediately get your 3 or more triggers off. You want to make it so that, like, your game plan gets rolling early and that you have choices in your opener, because Martell should generally be running 2 different options to open. Riddle, and it might even only be Riddle and At the Gates, right? But being able to say, okay, I'm going to Riddle now and save At the Gates, or I'm going to At the Gates into At the Gates, like, depending on that coin flip, is also really big.
Follow up, when is it time not to open
Prince? When you know for sure what your opponent is opening and it's something you don't care to behest. Like, if I know for sure my opponent is Naveling, if I know for sure my opponent is Riddling, I might not behest. I might just play something else. But, like, that requires scouting. Like, we're assuming we're not scouting here, and Team Martell scouted exactly zero games. So, if assuming we're not scouting, if you have behest, you open behest. Wamba would disagree. He likes using it mid-game when he wants to reset.
I mean, maybe there's some, you know, possible uses there, but I think that takes, I mean, it's obviously always going to take careful play, but the earlier you play a card like Prince Dorn's Behest, like, theoretically, like, just numbers kind of speaking, not juking people on an outplay, like, there's a higher ceiling for what you can do because you have more pots to pick from. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just like digging through the top of your deck, right? A card that said look at the top two cards and pick one is good, but not as good as one that says look at the top 10 and pick one.
Yeah.
Similar principle here.
I agree. I think what Wamba was suggesting is 4-6-1, Stark loves it. Help me. Return to the field, return of the field, return something field.
Return to the field.
Return to the fields.
Yeah.
Is like, if you think they might return to the fields or march their key dude, you can behest and then, like, see what they do before you commit to your plot. That's a viable play. It's just you're sort of sticking yourself with zero initiative there, and that's really painful.
I mean, but if you're going to Valor, you already had zero initiative. Yes. So.
There's two Valors, though, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. But I mean,
Forcing yourself second on a Doharis turn is not always ideal, or forcing yourself first on a Doharis turn, as the case may be.
Yep, yeah, it's all very true. Who wants to take up the next one?
Next one's real easy. I don't care. Anyone want it? Will?
Sure. Was this number four, Riddle? That's Varus' Riddle versus Summer Harvest. First player decides if Harvest gets 2 gold or 7. So go first if you have Riddle. You're right. It's straightforward. I don't know what else there is to say about that.
It's very easy to forget, though. I forget this interaction all the time. And I also forget, technically, I think they cleared it up in the rules to make it a little less technical. But I always forget, like, what order you're supposed to say things in as well. So
I think you want Riddle to resolve second, right?
Yeah.
The last one of the effects will be the one that
you would want Riddle to resolve second, but it does not matter. First player just says 2 or 7. Like, it doesn't matter. There's no order of triggering. Okay. Literally, first player just says you get 2 gold or you get 7 gold. Since there's,
that's what it was that was streamlined.
Gotcha. I don't remember why, because I don't care for that kind of thing. But there was a whole explanation for it. It's just, if you Riddle a Harvest, just remember you go first. We were opening Riddle a fair amount because we expect a lot at the gates, and it's got really good initiative in Martell, so it's often a 7 gold opener.
Yeah, very fair. Prince's plan, use it when you know you're going to lose and have extra gold on and someone standing. Then when the challenge resolves, take it back immediately. So why does that play pattern so strong, Glazer?
Let's say an opponent towers me for the end of their phase, or military, don't really care. I don't defend, but I've got a standing whoever. I use the Prince's Plan on them, right? With Water Garden, whatever, Kedri, so on. That character is now Tricon with like 8 or 9 strength that was not expected. And then I immediately get the Prince's Plan back. So if I have more gold, if I have another way to like reduce it, I can immediately Prince's Plan again. It's a way to get multiple really, really strong characters in the house that's not super known for that. Cool. Prince's Plan is one of the most underrated cards in the game.
It was. We did not rate it very highly when we reviewed it here.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think we decided it was expensive and a little too little too late, right?
It is not, in fact. Like, even just the icon is sometimes... Like, I had a one-up in the Fealty. Even just the icon is stellar. Just being able to be like, all right, I have a power icon now. You didn't know I did. Is really, really good.
Following up on Prince's plan, Dane, Escort, Desert Raider, don't forget them. Keep them sideways in their pile, so that would be for Prince's plan and Dane, Escort in the discard pile, Desert Raider in the dead pile, so that you can see them and be reminded. I mean, this is like a huge thing to keep in mind. It's like I make mistakes on all the time. You know, when I play like Drown God, I forget what's in my dead pile exactly, if it's not like at the top card or I just put it in there. You know, I'll lose track of events or something like that. It's like four cards down or something. And so just sort of making sure that you can clearly mark, you know, of course, fully legal way, what you have access to is just going to be so much easier, particularly as you approach round four, five, six, or seven of a tournament when, you know, your mental toughness isn't necessarily at its highest point.
And a slight corollary to that, if we're directing this at new players, part of the reason this is important is you technically can't just change the order of your dead or discard piles whenever you want, like, for no reason, right?
You can't do that. I think the discard pile, there's no rule.
There's no.
Because people
remember jump. First edition Prince's plan. What is that? What it was? Was it actually the Prince's plan?
No.
What was it?
Yeah. They would put the top four back.
So it mattered in first edition, but it has not thus far in second.
I also think that, like, I mean, I've seen people just reorder their discard pile at top level Thrones tournaments, and no one has said anything. The dead pile, people don't do that because there's interactions with the top card of your dead pile. But people, my opponents, myself, have reordered discard piles. Like, I actually really just, I mean, purely on a game design level, I despise pile tracking like that. Like, I think it's dumb. You know, like, if you look at many other card games, they don't do that kind of pile tracking, because just there's just so many things that can go wrong, both dishonestly and just in good faith, that can destroy a good a board state. So, like, I don't think Ghost of Harrenhal is a very well designed card for that reason. But but I'm pretty sure only right now the dead pile has to be kept in the specific order in which cards entered it. I think the discard pile could be reorganized, but really hardcore rulesies can correct me. I'm sure I'll hear from Colin or Wama.
Yeah. Someone can dig into that. I'm just going off of memory, and that is not always accurate from first to second ed. Yeah.
So the next one is Beguiled, Starfall, and Emeria. Functionally, any of the icon stealing stuff. Remember, you don't have to use them at the start of the phase, especially if you're a second player. You can use them to mess up an opponent's challenge order real, real well. New players constantly use their icon removal, like, immediately, like, haha, you don't have a military icon on, whatever. And, like, maybe they would have defended with that guy. You would have been able to take something else. Maybe you could have denied a later challenge by taking that away. Like, don't just take it away because you have it.
Definitely. It's all about having a purpose in that. You kind of alluded to there, it may even be punching through your own challenges. If you're second player, you know, for various uses, from, you know, an unopposed to win the game to Tears of Bliss or whatever, you know, you may be able to use this to keep their only defender out.
So. Yeah. Especially valid to not use right away if you have draw in the deck, right? Like, if you know you're going to be getting some kind of draw that phase, like, you might not know what you're going to get. And then you might be like, oh man, if I had known and been able to take away that or do that, I could have won.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a recurring theme here is don't commit to any game plan too fast. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that one's going to come up again with 8, which we already talked about, right?
Yeah. Well, here, I'll go ahead and read it out loud at least, but we did discuss it a moment ago. his Viper Eyes. Even if you're first, let your Sea of Blood opponent get first action. So let them search up their event, then you get rid of it.
Also phenomenal and hilarious, if you're a Sea of Blood opponent, wins that challenge, and then you pass actions, and then like they're like, all right, so blah, or like, I guess it would be the other way, right? Like, if you're second player, if they, like, ask you for actions and you pass, they just miss their Sea of Blood trigger.
Right. If you both consecutively pass. Because
if they're asking for your actions, that means they're implicitly passing theirs, right? Like, you can't have a reaction unless they haven't taken theirs.
Yeah. Though it's probably worth pointing out, I could see some players getting pretty salty about that. So, especially in, like, a tournament setting. I would probably, before passing myself, if they asked me, I would say, so you passed your action and get them to confirm that. I would not.
If you make that mistake, you're playing Sea of Blood. You're playing like straight cheese aggro. Like, keep track of your literal one trigger. You've got one trigger in the game you care about. If you can't keep track of your one trigger, I'm not going to try before you.
Sure. I'm just thinking about avoiding, like, salty judge calls.
Go do the salty judge call. You messed up. Play better.
I mean, Glazer, the problem with, like, cheesing, like, anything that could be seen as cheesing through an cheating. Action window.
Do you have any, like, actions? Asking second player means first player doesn't have actions, by definition. Because if, like, it doesn't, they can't have reactions. It, like, they can't. It's not possible.
I mean, I get where you're going. It's just enough on that line that I would be careful myself. That's all.
I'd be getting a judge
call. Yeah. Yeah, probably. But say, Levy, I mean, I think you should be particularly if you're in a situation where the specific ordering of triggers matters a lot, being clear that you have passed an action window and you're offering it to your opponent is important. Just
especially because we're all so loosey-goosey with action windows in general. I mean, none of us ever sit down at a game and ask, you know, pass action for every time we actually
should.
Some
people try. And I just start ignoring them and doing things quickly because I'm a jerk.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, agreed that it becomes
It's a card game, right? I'm not playing just cards. I'm playing my opponent. And, like, rushing an opponent that way, or, like, messing with an opponent's head by, like, making them be like, you got to remember your order, right, man? Is, like, part of the game. Sorry. Like, maybe not in Swiss, but certainly in the cut.
It is and it isn't. Like, I mean, I agree, like, there's a fundamental tension between, like, making sure that the appropriate steps are followed and, like, providing your opponent with a hint that makes them remember a trigger that it's clear that they were forgetting. But just in as much as it might hurt the competitive person in me, the person in me is always going to be err on the side of just being like, okay, we should be clear here what stage in the challenge resolution we're in, who's passed, who hasn't. Just to make sure that nobody feels like they were cheesed out of an opportunity to react to things. Particularly in a tournament game. Like, I don't care in Iron Throne games. Like, I've been people like, oh, you should have waited longer. I'm like, quite on the Iron Throne.
Everyone's like, smiling. People like, be careful with your marshaling. Like, you just redid it. I'm like, yeah, kiss my ass. It's Iron Throne. A casual game. I'm literally figuring out this deck right now.
but if I'm playing in a tournament, I'm going to, particularly in the challenges phase or in a point where it matters, or particularly if I'm trying to do something complicated, I'm going to be clear with the action windows to make sure that my opponent has the opportunity to respond and understand what I'm doing.
Yeah. I mean, it's just tricky because, like Roy was saying, you've got this tension here. On the one hand, you don't want to help your opponent such that you're, like, reminding them you're playing for them, but it's also on, you know, all players' backs to maintain an accurate board state. And I think, you know, trigger order is part of that board state.
I'm not helping people remember when they should trigger things. Sorry.
I don't want to help them remember. I just want to make them explicitly say they passed so that if they try to get salty, then I can just say, well, I mean, sorry, bro. You didn't implicitly pass. You explicitly passed.
Yeah, I don't super care about that. But we can move on. I think we're going in circles.
Yeah. Yeah. We devoted way more discussion to number 8 than I was expecting.
All right. Who wants number 9?
Oh, my man, old Bill Bone. Add him to your deck. He screws up Sea of Blood and plenty of other stuff, Balon and so on. Old Bill Bone is very, very powerful. Did he end up being in the deck you played?
I think every deck we have is a one of.
One of in every deck.
He's just too good. Nice. Like he's just saying no, your Sea of Blood doesn't get to trigger. Saying no, your Reigns. No, you can't use Balon. No, you.
Free folk.
No, not really. Secret schemes. Just like a million things. He just screws up one or two things and all. Yeah. Your king commands it, I think, was fantastic, which I shut down with it. It's very good.
Yeah. I think that I think you're pretty right. He's a very strong Chud, right? And, you know, he's not like a. He really is the kind of efficient, neutral answer card that Danny doesn't really print very often. Because there's really not a downside to running him, because at the end of the day, he's a 2-for-2 bicon with icons that just about every deck in the game needs. So even if you're not even just playing Martell, like old Bill Bone is a very safe bet in like 60-75% of decks. But we also, for number 10, generally only duplications against Greyjoy, Bannerkraken, or Sea of Blood, although Tyrell and Lannister may run Political Disaster. Although Jesse's name day, that was more of a stalking horse than actually anything.
Yeah,
really.
I didn't see a lot of PD. But that just means location dupe shouldn't be played unless you're playing Greyjoy, Bannerkraken, or C, right? Like, otherwise, just don't dupe your locations. It's a waste of intrigue fodder.
Yeah. Unless you're at reserve, right?
And you never know if you're going to lose an intrigue challenge. I'd generally rather just be safe. And you can usually tell pretty quickly if an opponent is running Political Disaster. Like, their location base is largely set up for it.
Yeah. Oh, excuse me. So, we reviewed this card, Glazer. So, number 11, Rivergate. You probably want to keep the gold a while before drawing. Talk a little bit about Rivergate.
So, mid to late game, if you haven't turned the game around, odds are you just need cards. Like, Doran is in very few Martell decks anymore, which means you're largely relying on Green Blood Secret Schemes. Littlefinger has found his way back into Martell decks. But, like, Rivergate is worse as an econ location than Rose Road or whatever the zero cost one is. I don't really care what the name of it is. But,
You want to feast them?
Way worse than that. It's explicitly worse. But like, that extra gold is usually not costing you anything severe in the early game. It'll put you slightly behind, but nothing super serious in the early game or on setup. That said, in the mid game, when you're much more likely to actually like need cards, being able to, and you have enough economy, especially given all the at the gates led economy that's everywhere, being able to sack it and get two gold on top, or get two, sorry, cards on top of the gold you've got in the game is really, really strong. I've used it to hit secret schemes multiple times, which is a real good feeling.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of cards. So, Glazer, talk about Prince's Pass, which is number 12.
Okay, Prince's Pass is... The reminder is that Desert Raider can trigger, then Prince's Pass can't discard any attacking bicon. Prince's Pass is phenomenal. It's one of the better Martell cards lately. Alejandro and I were screwing around, and I was like, wait a second, is Prince's Pass good? And he was like, God, I think it is. Because if your Desert Raider's in your dead pile, if, say, I don't know... Balon wins a challenge, right?
Real quick.
You can desert...
I'm gonna come in here real quick, Glazer, because I had to read the card when I played Alejandro, It's the Prince's Pass is a 2-cost loyal Martell location with the Doran trait, and it says reaction. After you lose a challenge as the defending player, kneel the Prince's Pass to choose an attacking character. Then until end of the phase, that character loses a challenge icon of your choice. Then, if it has no challenge icons, you may sacrifice the Prince's Pass to discard it from play.
So, Desert Raider takes an icon, Prince's Pass takes an icon. That character is now discarded from play.
Yeah.
Any bicon of Bramble Carly. And if you have 2 Desert Raiders dead, a Tricon is dead. If you have a Starfall, or Nim, don't use Starfall or Nim. Wait for Renly to attack and then sack Renly. It's real, real strong.
Yeah, it's a really cool card, particularly the way in which Martell has gone more into the icon control strategy in the post-Sea of Blood world. And has reached a sort of level of redundancy with those effects as well. Because I don't think Prince's Pest has really seen a lot of play in competitive Martell decks before this season, right?
Yeah, it's Desert Raider that makes it good. It's just, like, there's so many good bicons in the game, right? Like, someone had a Gregor against me, and I was like, oh, well, this seems like it's going to be useless. Like, your Gregors and your Drogons are, like, it's just another way to make those bad cards for their respective houses.
Which I love to hear. Those are 2 of my least favorite cards in the game. So, Sir Garrus, this is Sir Garrus Drinkwater, right? Use for Valor or you win or you die, generally speaking. So why target those 2 plots specifically, Aaron?
Well, it used to be those 2 or Trade Routes, but Trade Routes is now gone from basically every Martell deck. So double Valor is something that almost no one expects, although they'll be expecting it when you Garrus and take Valor back, obviously. Sure. But at that point, there's just often not anything they can do about it. Like even Greyjoy has trouble surviving 3 Valor Morghulises in one game. While you win or you die is just gaining, it's basically just draw 4 cards and get to claim twice, and that seems real good. It gives you double the chance to close the game.
Basically, use it on your highest impact plots. don't do something cutesy. Just if you're going to reuse it, go for sheer punch.
It also, like, if you have Garrus in hand or Shadows against basically anyone but Greyjoy, you can win or die or Valor, like, turn 2, which is usually a terrible play, knowing that, like, you can then, like, wait a turn, bring it back out, and then you use it again turn 4 or 5 if you need to.
I'd still be wary about doing that with you win or you die early, unless I really landed on some reserve boost already.
So a theory in Martell that we didn't end up using is running an Iron Throne along with 3 of the Summer Seaports.
Yeah.
But Iron Throne plus a few Summer Seaports means that, like, you're pretty much always at +2 reserve.
Fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Keeping 2 is not terrible if you're then again 2 turns later just going to be drawing 2 more.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, usually when you die, your hand is small enough that 2 cards are usually 2 really good cards, and everything else is chafe.
Mm-hmm.
And you're probably disrupting their hand with an intrigue challenge at 2 claim also. So
yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. What about Shadow City Bastard, Will?
You skipped 14.
I apologize. Since I skipped it, I'll say it. Hota's Axe. Don't get it stuck on someone who gets it stuck in play. Keep it on bouncers. Yeah, pretty straightforward.
The appeal's the surprise, right? Like, where are you going to commit it? So don't leave it somewhere where there's no surprise anymore.
Also, I didn't know this at the time, but it's really, really good on I don't even know, the new Martell Shadows guy, the one that discards a card to jump out of Shadows, because Surprise 7 Strength is really good against Sea of Blood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can see that.
Absolutely.
It's the only place I ever really get it stuck, and then I pretty quickly usually just march that away to get it back. Because, again, I want that in and out as much as possible. Like, even your Shadow City Bastards at 4 Strength are pretty solid.
Yeah, fair. Yeah. That's a very reasonable amount of strength at that point. And more effect besides after you throw in a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Alright, so Shadow City Bastard then.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's our connection right there, Shadow City Bastard. Don't leave in play as Flea Bottom target. You can trigger them on themselves if necessary. Don't expect a reset, only trigger them if you need to. So, I mean, this feels like a bit more of the, like, don't commit to a plan too early sort of thing, right? Don't use them if you don't need them, and keep them somewhere that they're going to be as safe as possible for what sort of situation that is coming up, right? So, like, in play, maybe safer till you need them if your opponent is running Mirani's Market or Isle of Ravens, right? But if the reset's coming, you may be safer in the discard pile so they don't die and can't be used at all.
Yep. And it's important to note, people tell me I'm wrong all the time, but Danny literally ruled this at Gen Con for me, that you can, like, if there's no eligible target, they are, when triggered, their own eligible target. So they can trigger to try and take away their own icon, which means that, like, oh no, they have only, I don't know, Bob out, and you want to make a power challenge. You can pop them out, make a power challenge, and then they're not stuck out going to the bottom. They just trigger on themselves in your set. It's also nice to, if they're the only thing out, try and make your opponent military challenge foolishly instead of intruder power. So try and get them. You're like, yeah, I'll just trigger it on myself, but you can't do that. And like, yeah, I get it. Thanks.
Didn't say other.
That feels funny based on some other stuff I only halfway remember at this point, so I'll take your word for it right now. But
that's 100%.
Okay.
Like, literally, Danny ruled it.
Well, yeah, no, I'm not saying Danny didn't. I'm also just saying, you know, designers, developers don't always rule correctly under the rules framework.
Fair, but yeah, at the time of triggering, there is a valid target.
I'll roll with it.
Glazer, what about Kohor?
Don't use the agenda all the time. Martell has a lot of control tricks. The icon control is really good, but it's meant to take care of major threats. It's not there for, like, you can play a regular control game. You can win triggering Kohor, like, once or twice in a game. Don't trigger it just to trigger it. If you have the right attachment that you want out, just leave it alone. If there's if you have an attachment out that's kind of useless and there's nothing that's really going to improve your situation, leave it alone. Don't trigger it just to trigger it. It's better to have the option to later get the attachment you want than trigger it early and just be sad later when you really wish you had that option.
Yeah. Back to that theme.
This is an important one for me, both when I played Venomous Blade and played against it. Venomous Blade is printed strength. You have to remember that. It is one of the more interesting and sometimes frustrating interactions with that card. You know, if characters one strength, doesn't matter how many walls, Winterfell,
Halder.
Halders, yeah. You've got in the world. It's dying to V-Blade.
That does send me to my question. Is that essentially the only scenario this is really important, like, against Night's Watch? Are there other houses where that pops up very much?
Stark
with Winterfell. It's really big, but it hits Arya.
It's Arya, it hits Bran, it hits Mira, it hits a lot of good... Does it hit Alicent?
It does, in fact, hit Alicent. I don't know that. Like, and then Stark, unfortunately, which is very, very stupid, has the best Winter's Blade answer in the game, has Kohor. What? No, has,
Skagos.
Skagos is a very good, but, like, in fairness, within a couple turns of Venblade, you can almost always make sure that, like, they're just out of that character unless they got lucky and saw an early aisle.
Yeah, and like, forcing the Skagos on a, like, unappealing target, like, if you hit their Mira with a V-Blade, like, and then they have to Skagos her, like, that's bad for Stark. That's screwing up their whole game plan, right? Like, Skagos is best for Stark when they're using it on their own terms. And so if you force them into a situation where they have to burn through those copies that are in their deck or just screw up their sacrifice plan, you're ahead.
You know, one other thought I'm surprised not to see here with Venomous Blade is, doesn't the same advice basically apply to this as applies to Hotaw's Axe? Stick this on bouncers so you can keep getting it back to continue getting triggers?
Yeah, definitely true. Probably should be there. Good call. Venblade definitely needs to stick on bouncy characters. Arion is my single favorite Venblade target in the game, where possible.
Yeah.
Because it's very, very, very nice to have her at 5 strength and out of range for a lot of annoying effects. And then get her butt out of play right there. And then sometimes you can even just jump Venomous back in too.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What's the next one, Glazer?
He's up on 18.
If you have Isle of Ravens, get rid of their Flea Bottom targets before they have Flea Bottom. Don't just wait for them to draw Flea Bottom, because then they're going to usually have two pennies. Assuming that you know that it's a Flea Bottom deck. Either way, just keeping their deck nice and thick and less likely to see answers is not the worst idea. Don't willy-nilly shuffle your own stuff back in. Generally speaking, you want your deck thinner, not thicker. So unless there's a specific answer card that you need to see again, just leave it in the discard. So that was actually Buzz Aldrin's big thing, where like he was like, Isle of Ravens shouldn't be in just every deck. And we're like, yeah, I think it should be in most. They're like, he's like, all right, fine. You shouldn't be using Isle of Ravens on yourself most of the time in every deck. I was like, that's fair. Like, unless you're running, like, I play against Sea of Blood players sometimes, and I'll discard, like, a put to the sword on Intrigue, and they'll shuffle it back in immediately, and I'm always like, you know you have more than one in that deck. Like, all you're doing is increase the likelihood that you top deck it instead of good characters. Like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, don't do it. Just leave your discard pile the way it is most of the time. You want a thinner deck, not a thicker one. Unless it's late and you're going to be decked or whatever nonsense, right? Like, a thinner deck is better than a thick deck.
Also, or it's a card you specifically want to top deck, like a Milk or a Craven or something like that. Like, having your deck full of those cards.
Attachments are a generally good idea for shuffling it. Unless you're playing Night's Watch and the attachment is Milk. Against Night's Watch.
Yeah. Vengeance for Elia should be played early with Intrigue and Military Power late. That's pretty self-explanatory.
The best feeling in the world, I think, is a late power challenge that would win them the game. Vengeance for Elia. If you're like, I'm going to power for 15. You don't even have a power icon. Ha ha. I've got just enough renown to get to 15. You're like, cool. You're going to sit at 13. Now I'm going to Desert Raider, and you'll be at 14, but now I can swing back. It's very good.
Yeah. Particularly the military option is really only appealing early. I mean, or in some situations, like right after a reset or something. But
to claim, I think it's very tempting anytime they've got to claim. The aggregate of them losing at least those two characters plus whatever gold investment and maybe a third on your own military challenge, that adds up a lot.
Yeah, fair. It's a good way to get. It's a good way to clear dupes for a Valor too.
To claim is much more present in the meta than it has been in a long time. So that is a very fair play pattern.
Win die against Myrtle generally just makes me happy. If my opponent plays it, I usually feel like I'm in a good place. The only exception, really, is a double Drogo that I can't handle. But if it's not a double Drogo, like, when my opponent Wind dies against Martell, I'm usually just like, all right, I'm in really good shape because I can survive a bad attrition turn pretty easily.
Yep.
All right. What about Sea of Blood, Aaron?
The trigger isn't that important. It's the threat of the trigger is really important, which is why you can sometimes afford to just go second with your Sea of Blood. But it's really about making them overcommit to defend, because Martell plays a control game, not an aggro game. it's not about hitting that Sea of Blood trigger every time, or even most of the time. It's about making them be wary of it, so then you can do other things. You don't win by killing their characters. Which is also the theory behind the Stark Sea of Blood, by the way.
Yes. Although I do think the Stark Sea of Blood cares more about getting that early trigger off.
I don't think so.
But I could be wrong.
I just don't think it cares. Like, it's like, it would love to, right? Like, nothing's worse by getting off an early important put, whichever one. Like, no deck is made worse by that for free when you can search it, right? But, like, neither deck needs to do that to win. Like, it's not, their plan is to make you defend that, to make you suffer for trying to stop it, because that lets them win a bunch of intrigue and power challenges. And then when you have no cards and they have all the power, it doesn't super matter anymore.
Fair. I still think, since Stark's main thing that it lacks is control elements, like hard control elements, a Sea of Blood is, the agenda is much more important for Stark than it is for Martell.
Maybe.
I think Martell is just adding like an additional redundancy to it, but I could of course be wrong, but or perhaps I'm just playing against people playing Stark Sea of Blood poorly, because a lot of Stark Sea of Blood players I play against, they go in on those first couple of turns to try to lock you out. Now, they have a mid-range game plan to back themselves up if that doesn't go off, but unlike, say, Greyjoy or some of the other Sea of Blood decks, where if they get disrupted early, you're usually pretty good. Stark can play from behind because Wyman is just such a powerful card, but they still want to just shove it in your face early, and they'll come pretty hard for you.
I'm pretty sure Greyjoy C should just be playing the Pinch Raider thing as they're restricted. And Greyjoy C should always be running 7-cost Asha. Like, I don't get running the Stealth Asha in it. Like, selling out for the trigger is just wrong. Like, you need to be able to see cards, and, like, Sonic Greyjoy has an abundance of other draw.
Yeah, I mean, I do prefer the card advantage Asha to the Stealth Asha myself, but I lost to Stealth Asha at Thrones War in round one, so couldn't beat her. So,
and how many factions can survive a Raider Pinch and a Sea of Blood trigger?
Yeah,
like if you can get both. Yeah, off, but I mean, it's like just over.
It's hard to find room for the puts, the torches, and the pinches. So,
to me, just run 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I don't think so. It's 12 spots.
Yeah.
At most.
Oh, 12.
Is that counting the Raider?
Probably the Raider. 11 spots. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, counting the Raider. But the Raider is just a little military icon, right? You're just replacing whatever chud with Raider. Like, it's probably an Orcmont Reaver spot or something, right? It's fine.
All right. Well,
where are we? 21?
We're 21? With Return to the Fields. And Aaron, I know Return to the Fields in Martell is one of your babies, so what's so good about it?
It lets you just dump out a board. Like, you can play it when you expect your opponent to reset. You can also just play it the turn before you plan to reset. Martell struggles to get a board early and maintain a board. If you can just dump them knowing you have Return to the Fields, it's really good. Also, House Dane Escort is really, really good with Return to the Fields.
Yeah. No, it's good. Yeah. Nope. I mean, I think Return to the Fields is a underrated plot outside of Fat Cat or 7-cost Cat Combo Cat. Yeah. Very strong.
I think you've definitely brought me around on it.
It's really good in target too.
If you can catch an opponent's reset with Return to the Field, you feel real good.
Mm-hmm. And if you can, it's just like, all right, well, I'm just going to have like an 8 gold, 10 card turn. Feels real bad to like get your Greyjoy or Stark opponent down to almost no cards, have them return to the fields and
it's true.
Bust your face.
First March, Forced March, its name is its aim. You're forcing a march on your opponent, so you should use it for early tempo, usually turn two or three. There are a lot of decks in this Sea of Blood heavy meta that can't really survive having two or three of its military icons knelt on the first turn. And so very, very strong play. And plus you get to just go second. Very good.
Seems reasonable.
Also, Sea of Blood decks are usually going to force march you either turn two or three. So if you can figure out when they're going to do it to time it, that's usually really helpful. So they just want to keep that one big guy standing to get you with. If you can deal that big guy, you're usually in a good spot.
Windeye?
Another one kind of hit on earlier, huh?
Generally use it 5, 6, 7, unless you're planning on garrisoning. It's your closer, and you'd like to see reserve before you use it, which seems obvious, but sometimes people are like, oh, like, plan to play your extra reserve things, please, before you win die.
Oh, very fair. Marched to the wall. So, go to the old school. There's like, and don't be afraid to open it if you see a really high priority target. Only use it on a thin board of low priority targets when opponent's hand is thin and you have extra attrition like Vengeance for Elia. So, you just sort of want to make sure you are maximizing the tempo spot when you use it later in the game, but don't be afraid in that first turn if your opponent gets greedy to just punish them. And there's a lot less of it these days. Marched is a lot less present in plot decks overall. So people are much greedier with awkward setups when it comes to characters, and you can really punish them and blow them out.
I had a lot of people planning to open, when I've been playing attrition, planning to open at the gates, keep a big guy reducer set up, and just two big guys set up, and it's just really nice to march one, and then be like, all right, so you're going to have 6 gold and one guy left, or no guy. Good luck.
Yeah.
Like, giving Bartel that kind of attrition head start is good.
All right. Aaron, you want to bring us home with the Valors?
All right, last move.
Both show.
The Valors. Doharis. Doharis you save for as long as possible. Do not use it the instant there are 2-6 cost drops on the board. I feel like that's what most new players do, and it's really easy to both predict and punish. You need to wait at least an extra turn anytime you want to use it if you're not immediately going to lose the game. If you're immediately going to lose the game, you have to play it. If you're not going to lose the next turn, play it the turn after.
Yeah.
Again, don't commit all right. Too early.
Yeah. Valador Harris is in the current meta, I think, is a very hard plot to time properly, because the top factions have sort of spread out their cost curve enough that it's, they have about 3-6 cost characters. And of course, a good player will put two out and bait you into it and then have the follow up there. So I think timing your Doharis to the most opportune moment requires a lot more thought than it did maybe 6 months to a year ago. So definitely keep this in mind when playing Martell, but also when playing other factions as well.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, Morghulis. Don't be afraid to take a couple of big targets early if the opponent doesn't have dupes. If they've left a couple of big guys unprotected, unless they're playing Return, i.e. Stark, just Valor them. Just get them right in the face nice and early. That is, with the caveat that you have seen a fair amount of economy. Don't do it if you're sitting on like 3 gold total that turn. But assuming you've seen a fair amount of economy, don't be afraid to Valor them, especially if you think they're going to count it or something and not have economy.
Yeah. These are really great, Aaron. I think they do a good job of sort of highlighting the big picture of of where Martell is in the current meta. Did your team find these helpful?
They said they loved it. People printed it out. They read it before each match. There was a lot of stuff. There's also, which again, we're not going over, there's advice for how to play Martell against each other house specifically. So like, it was from what I hear, very useful. One thing that shows up in, I think, every house, but not the general Martell, is I no longer run Martell without at least two Begging Brothers.
Begging Brother is very powerful.
I mean, if you have a Begging Brother and it ends my game, then that's sad, right? Like, I have to have my own to counter that. Begging Brother is too important in the current meta. And there's enough gold, so it's not, they're not as hard to play in Martell.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's the main thing holding them back in some factions is, you know, a neutral 5 to 6 gold sink is really hard for some factions, even good ones.
Yeah, I just play them as a 4 pretty often. I think it's just I need to make sure you don't have that one Vince when I really want to do something.
Fair.
Yeah. I mean, and then you've still got the threat of activation, at least. That can throw off a lot of people's game plans, just worrying over how to bait you out and get the one they want through.
Yeah. And I've seen people, like, Balon, then I Begging Brother, and then they try and do it again. And I'm like, oh, your faction smells, sorry. Very, very good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Absolutely. Well, hopefully you all found this useful. I think we're going to be doing this for other factions, right, Will?
Yeah, I think that's our game plan. This seems like a really fun way to tackle this kind of thing.
So I'm going to, not that he knows it, relatively soon, I'm probably going to harass Jim Hansen to talk about para cards to do this for Mara. And I'm likely to bug Colt Humbert to do this for Terrell.
Okay.
So I'll try and find, like, major players / builders who are known for that faction in order to continue to compile these. Assuming they're willing. They could both tell me to go to hell. They should. They probably should. Doesn't mean they will.
Well, for our sake and the listeners' sake, I hope they don't.
Me too. Well, if Jim says go to hell for Barra, it's not like there's a wealth of famous Barra players in the world, right?
That's true.
Start begging Hano to, like, make time.
That kick us over to props and slops?
Props and slops. Is this our first episode since Jesse's name day that Aaron and I have been on?
It is.
That you guys have, yeah.
So I guess I want to prop my winning teammates at Team Night's Watch. We brought it home in a pretty convincing victory. It was super great to be drafted by Jordan and Martin and onto sort of like Team East Coast and Friends. It was a great group of folks to build with. I had an amazing time. It was a really great environment, a really fun day of group. It was just a fantastic time, all things considered. Yeah. And Jesse ran an amazing event. I'm super proud of him. And Wausau, we now know, is proud of him too.
Oh, the newspaper article.
You read that newspaper article.
Weirdly off one. That was very good. I want to prop Team Martell. We didn't win. We played really well. We played really hard. We had, I think, 6 or 7 players on the team at 4 wins going to the last round. And we didn't quite make it as well as we wanted to against Greyjoy, but a lot of that was just like, if everyone moved one table over, we win a lot of those matches. And that's just going to happen sometimes in the format.
All right.
The other thing, I do want to slop a thought that I had about the format that, like, I've been discussing with multiple people, that I wanted to make a major part of a segment at the, a major part of a segment where I on last week, but I was not able to be because it was just back for a day and life happens. I think passive power of the type of new wall and the type of
new,
sorry,
wall?
Old wall. Ooh, sorry, I've been talking to Jesse. She's been talking to Jesse. Sorry, old wall builder type decks and drowned god type decks. I think that might just kind of be broken in the format. I don't think they're broken if you bring one or two, but I think if everyone brings the same one, there's only so many decks that have answers for them that they're just going to consistently roll that format. And I don't think that's necessarily healthy.
It sounds like a fun segment for the future episode, not something I'm really interested in debating this particular moment with you, particularly builders with you. I think we should, I don't know if, I assume y'all did this, but I want to make sure that I say it. I want to prop our former co-host, who came in second, at Jesse's Name Day, Asa Haynes. So who helped relaunch this podcast into second edition. That was part of the generation of hosts that joined with me. He's an all-around good kid, so I really...
Oh, she's an adult now. What is she, like 25?
That old?
Maybe, I don't know. Aaron, you were just talking about, and somewhat excitedly, about being the oldest person.
I think you're attributing a tone that wasn't there.
I think they'll always be the kid to you.
I think you're attributing a tone to me that wasn't there. I was just noting my age.
No, I'm pretty sure this whole insistence that 3 years made you that much older implicitly means you
lording it. Okay, so what am I, Greg? What am I, Greg Atkinson or something?
It's
23, by the way.
It's 23. It's gonna get worse every time I.
They're 23.
So okay. Yeah, no, I mean that's a pretty triumphant return, if not literally the win. So
we should also prop the lobster. Sean Emberley won, was on this podcast last week.
Yes.
Talking about taking his victory
lap. I assume
lap.
You talked about that.
We should still prop him. Like, he's our teammate. We have to act like we're proud, even though we actually are. We are really proud.
We are proud. It's well deserved and hard fought. Emberley's been one and thirsty for this kind of success for a very long time, and ever since he lost that Canadian Nationals finals, and I know how important it is for him to win a big tournament, and much less the biggest tournament in North America, probably until Worlds. Although we'll see, Will's going to be in a castle that might pull a lot of people to U.S. Nationals, but.
Fingers crossed.
It's gonna certainly be one of the biggest tournaments of the year, no matter what. And so it's such a huge accomplishment. So congratulations to Haynes and Emberley for their big success and a well fought final table, as far as I understand it.
Yep. Agreed.
I don't know if there's any way that the worst to come can beat that deck.
Fair.
The Martell Wars can beat Ground Down. It doesn't do anything that really
for a half second there. I was hoping you were just throwing shade at another podcast.
I mean, that podcast did well that day. CT made the top eight, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
Beyond the Wall won the tournament, right? Like, that's really White Book came second. I mean, the White Book came in second, sure. So yes.
We'll take it. We'll take it.
And then Second Sons was top four.
No, Second Sons. I mean, was Jesse was in the
no.
Jesse won his no. Jesse, no, he Jesse wasn't. Was he didn't win 16. His win in. He was in the same spot as me.
Then all of us are top.
We were just in the top 32. Just, I mean, overall, White Book, Second Sons,
we're the one
did better than everybody. But,
booyah!
Yes. Because we claimed Ace.
Yeah, well, I didn't see anybody else jumping to do it, so first come, first serve.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
So yeah, I think that's basically it. Let's see, the next time I will be on will be after Endgame comes out, so we can have our a very long rambling discussion about Endgame.
Slops to you two.
To him also, or to both of us? Which two?
To both of you. Both of you for being so negative on the first episode of Game of Thrones this season. I thought it was exactly what I expected. and B, more internally logically consistent than I expected from Benny.
I mean,
maybe.
Like it was gonna be the first episode Redux.
The very first episode of the series, you mean? You're talking about, yeah. The mirroring was really cool. I like that concept. I'm just not sold that the execution of the episode was great.
I don't feel like I was particularly harsh towards the episode. Like, my shortened version of it was like perfectly fine. It started really strong and ended pretty strong and kind of lost its way a little bit in the middle. But like, I just,
yeah.
I like the middle. I wasn't against all the catch-ups. Like, these characters have to meet and talk to each other.
I have no problem with the individual moments of the episode. I just feel like, as a viewing experience, it like kind of slowed down a little bit to a crawl towards the middle. And like, I mean, I guess we should do a full spoiler alert here. I don't think we're going to go super deep.
We hadn't given anything too bad so far.
Deep, right? But like, I'm not going to get into some things. I don't care about the King's Landing plot. I don't care about the characters anymore. I actively dislike Euron. Like, I just do not enjoy this time he's on the screen.
This interpretation of Euron is bad.
This one is worse than the child molester / complete psychopath in the books?
Yeah, like, that's terrifying. This Euron is just an upjumped frat bro, which, frankly, is not interesting for me to watch.
Fair enough.
I just don't find him compelling villain, and I don't really get his purpose.
So nothing anyone with the surname Greyjoy has ever done has interested me, ever. In the show and the books, they bore me to tears. So guess what? Still bore me to tears. Like, I'm not going to suddenly, oh, great, he saved Asha. Go away, or whatever, Yara, stupid name.
Let's just go with Asha.
Yeah, I just don't care. I just don't care. They're all so dumb. Like, everything about their code is dumb and reductive, and like, they're boring. I don't care about them.
Yeah, I mean, I think overall, I'm not like super down, like angry about the episode or anything. I'm just kind of bummed. Like, it's just not what I want. Like, not to the level that I want, even the earlier seasons were. I think the first line of the show really cements for me the like rapid downhill tumble we've seen since they ran out of Martin's writing, like direct writing to work from, when like Tyrion's, I think, sardonic wit is reduced to ball jokes to a eunuch. Like, that's our opener. Like, that, this is what this has become. Tyrion has become like an idiotic middle schooler. Okay.
So here's exactly how I want to say this, I think. It's one of the 3 to 5 strongest episodes since we stopped doing Martin's stuff. Since they've been out on their own in the wild, it's one of the 3 to 5 strongest episodes.
I mean, yes. I don't know. Like, I don't have the strongest. So, like, what? When did they fully depart? Season 5 is when they fully departed. Maybe season 3.
Yeah, I think so.
I always forget the exact timeline of the show. Like, John dies at the end of season 5, right?
No, 4. I thought.
No,
I don't know.
But whatever. Once they get off that thing, like, I don't know, all episodes blur together. Like, it's hard for me to remember specific episodes besides like the obviously big deal ones, like the Battle of the Bastards, and
I've really been like
all
that episode.
Stuff. It was
fine.
It was fine. Like I think it was really well executed in what they wanted to accomplish, and it was good to finally be rid of Ramsay, but like, a lot of like the specific choices that they made didn't really work for me, but I mean, that's just kind of the story of the show in this its second half, which is like, I enjoy a lot of the plot moments. I love a lot of the actors and their interpretations of characters, but like, and I'm excited to see where the ending of the show goes, and I want answers, but like, the specific interpretive choices that they make, I don't always gel with me. Yeah. So, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you want, you can listen to on YouTube, Watchers on the Couch with myself, Jesse, and CT, where we really go into this. It was a lot of fun to record. So, yeah.
Check it out.
Great.
Well, I do have one other prop that I want to make sure I slip in this week, and that is to the 2-on-2 tournament that we had here locally this past weekend. We took to calling Two-Headed Titan, a play on the Magic format, which is called Two-Headed Giant, and a bit of a reference to the Titan of Braavos, which, alas, is not two-headed in the books, but I can hope. At least, I really love alliteration, so it works out. But regardless, it's kind of a fun little format. I liked it for a change of pace. And you can do some really interesting slash kind of sick stuff with a teammate. I'm not sure that we found anything much that needs tweaked as far as considering an updated restricted list or banning anything. But, man, Bestow can get really nasty when both teammates are running favors from the crown, for instance. And you have a Martell teammate, I think, using secret schemes for 9 on turn 2, if I remember nice. Right. That was good times. It's also a great feeling to see your Iron Banks start with 3 gold on turn 1. I never got to experience that. I never drew an Iron Bank out of my deck all day, but my teammate did, so that was okay. Yeah, you can do some cool stuff. I dig it. And it is a format where At the Gates is not played as an opener, so that's kind of enjoyable.
A couple of things I just remembered. Thank you, because this is going to come out on the 26th, right?
I believe so.
Since we're recording on the 25th, definitely, Roy.
Well, what are we recording on the 25th?
This episode right now. It is the you suck.
Oh, sorry.
Did not play. Yeah.
Well, 25th is my birthday, so I was going to thank everybody for their well wishes for my birthday. And I also want to make sure that everyone knows that Trial by Combat is going on in New Jersey on the 27th. It is the third necked event of the year. It's incredibly exciting. Chris Back has amazing prize support. I, for one, would really love a set of those Aaron power tokens that he made up as a top 8 or top 16 prize, and they're just really cool and really sweet. Could almost tempt me away from playing with my Long Lances power tokens, but that's how good they are. So, yeah. So, come out on the 26th, New Jersey, for Neck 3 of 2019.
Yeah. I'm actually glad you brought that stuff up, because you did remind me I should probably be propping the first player championship on May 25th, a month after that. So check it out. We're going to have lots of cool prizes, and there's some pre-ordered or bonuses if you pre-register by the 1st. We're going to be giving out some cool plus and minus challenge icon tokens.
Cool. Yep. Exciting weekend that's going to be.
Exciting weekend that's going to be, Roy says in this like very subdued tone of voice. Come on, you've got way more exciting things going on that weekend. Yeah. Way more.
It's true. I'm immensely excited. I will be closing the chapter of the closing the book of one chapter of my life and beginning another. So.
There you go. Volume 2.
Volume 2.
Yeah, now with 100% yeah. more.
Thank you.
Danger Zone.